babes, and welcome back to another midweek episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings Podcast. This week, our little midweek miracle is told by Gary Simons, who describes himself as a neurosurgeon, writer, educator, and speaker. Gary has a lot of stories to tell and was a biochemistry major at Dartmouth College. He then went on to medical school at Rutgers and had a neurosurgery residency and medical research fellowship at Walter Reed Hospital. And Gary and I have a really powerful conversation about what it looked like to be a neurosurgeon and be operating on people's brains, on their spines, victims of car crashes, of gun violence, and what it was like to be present for the families of those who'd suffered such trauma. His miracle is such a simple yet powerful one, and one that I would have never considered. But after years of operating in neurosurgery, Gary really, really felt that the miracle that he shared this week, this was what was most powerful. I was so grateful to him for giving me the time and having this conversation. I'm always looking for diverse and interesting guests, and Gary absolutely is that. So now, without further ado, episode 160 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
Waiting rooms are always packed full of, you know, people who are crying and nervous as all get out. And you go and you say, you know, we're done and everything seems to have gone very well. And we're going to see how the, and, you know, invariably mother, father kind of almost fall onto you crying and thanking you. And I don't even know how you can express what that feels like. It's otherworldly. And so I don't know if you call that a miracle or whatever it is. It's humanity probably at its most acute.
Who are you as a human being?
That's starts off with a big one, doesn't it? Because you have to have some introspection, and I need to get back to that. But no, I mean, if I really want to get down to who I am, I would like to think of myself really just as a good person, somebody, I don't know, who wants to spread a little bit of joy and happiness around and help people out when they need it. I've always, the flip side to that, my kind of dark side is I can't stand bullies and cruelty. So that's the thing, if you want to get me riled up, that would be the alleyway. But otherwise, I really just try to be as good a person as I can. And I've kind of always gone by a mantra of working hard and being of good cheer.
One of the things my audience doesn't know about you is that you had sort of a stressful job, and you might sort of still have that stressful job. You and I are meeting for the first time in this interview. Explain what that job was. And then did you find it challenging to create that balance to like work hard, but then have good cheer in your life?
Yes and no. To the second part of the question, I can always get back to the first one in a second here, but there's no question that there was a lot of fatigue involved and a lot of lost sleep, and that will always drain somebody a little bit of their resources and maybe their good cheer. But I would say, you know, the work was so inspirational that it was hard not to be at times. So what I did for decades was I was a neurosurgeon, and, you know, meaning kind of in classical terms, a brain surgeon, but also we operate on spines a lot as well. And always worked at these big medical centers with big trauma components. So there was always all sorts of emergencies coming in all the time. And as a matter of fact, it always feels like the emergencies coming in the middle of the night rather than the nice working hours. So a lot of your life as a neurosurgeon in a situation like that is spent in the middle of the night rushing in for emergencies and going to the operating room and stuff along with your day job. And pretty much for most of my career, we would be up most of the night, every third night, every fourth night, thankfully later on. And so that goes back to that idea that, yeah, you're often a little bit fatigued, but the key to the point and key to the question for me is that what you saw of your fellow human beings was almost always inspirational. There was just so much humanity, so much, I don't know, kindness and caring and empathy from a lot of the healthcare providers, and then the patients and their families. Talk about humanity and talk about, you know, just courage under fire, if you will. And the only other word I've been able to find that in any way describes what I experienced, at least from the patients and their families, was just a sense of grace. I don't even know how else to even describe it. It was forever inspirational, that, you know, it made it easy to get out of bed and go to work even when you were tired. And how could I not be somewhat of good cheer when these people were facing the worst, you know, moments of their life with such bravery and grace?
I'm so curious, when you were a kid, did you already envision that you wanted to do this, or how did this happen? Because, you know, I look at what you did and I think to myself, okay, I couldn't, if I was a kid, I would have never been able to dream of that life path. And so I think it takes someone who's just extraordinary to kind of conceive of doing surgery on people's brains or spines. And I'm so intrigued by the answer to this question.
Geez, I wish I had a good answer for you. and thank you for all the compliments. But as a kid, I think I was going to be a football star, and then a rock star, and then a whole bunch of other stars. I think, you know, I medicine was creeping around, at least by the time I got to college, for one reason or another. I was also very much for a while there leaning into going into the ministry. And then in college, I started thinking of other things. We'd have all these recruiters come in. And so for a while there, I thought FBI, and then I thought CIA, and then I thought I'd be a fighter pilot. And so I was all over the place, but eventually decided on medicine. And I wish I had a more inspirational story about the neurosurgery side of it, but it was really kind of weird and funny in some ways, in that I was, another thing that happens in medical school is you kind of go through various incantations of what you might be. And I eventually landed on, I was going to be a cardiothoracic surgeon at the time. And I got to the last month of medical school and I saw my first brain operation. I said, oh my God, I have got to do that. So it wasn't this grand lead up to it of, you know, lots of thought and preparation. It was more a one thing, seeing one thing, I guess you could call it an epiphany. I don't know. But I was just like, I have got to do that. Had no idea what I was getting myself into, which was a lot. It's, you know, really jumping into the deep end, but never looked back, never regretted it.
And what I so appreciate about the brain is it's still so very mysterious for a lot of people, including, you know, that question, where does consciousness come from? And it's just such a fascinating organ. And I, of course, we're even discovering new organs still. I think they discovered one last year about the body. So there, in no way do we know everything about the human body, but the brain has always been, and I think because we affiliate it with consciousness, this mysterious domain. And so I'd love to hear, you know, what was your experience of the first time you operated on a brain? Were you so nervous?
I think, first of all, I agree with you on everything there is about the brain and the nervous system. It is truly, you know, some sort of magnificent and barely comprehensible organ, and, you know, the seat of everything that we are and do and all that. You never stop learning. So I read neuroscience all the time still, and, you know, we're discovering things all the time, and in each thing you discover, you're just even more amazed at the whole thing. That's part of the reason that made it really easy to just stay really involved with it through the years, because, I mean, we're just always learning new things and new techniques and all that sort of thing. I guess the whole process of becoming a doctor and all that sort of thing, in some ways, tries to tamp down getting too either excited or scared or emotional or nervous, which is a two-edged sword, because I don't think you want to go numb. I've spent a lot of time working in the field of burnout in healthcare. And, you know, one of the principal components is people going numb. And part of that is we make ourselves. Day one, there's a cadaver and you're working in there and working on a cadaver. And you got to learn how to kind of turn off certain parts of your brain, you know, and emotionality and reaction to those things, and kind of focus in on the job at hand. So I got to tell you, I think the first operations that I did, it wasn't like I felt extraordinarily nervous. I felt remarkably entitled. Not entitled is the wrong word. You know, just how lucky, I guess, I was to be there doing it. And yeah, you could call it blessed or whatever, but, you know, you do kind of stand there and go, oh my gosh, I thought I'd be, you know, maybe a rock star, and here I am, you know, looking at somebody's brain. So I think there's an awe more than a nervousness that came with it, for me at least.
I love the human body and all its complexity. And I just think it's still mysterious on so many levels. I recently read an article in Popular Mechanics that said, because I love physics as well. And basically the title was, scientists think they can explain consciousness, hint, we're connected to the entire universe. And it basically talks about an old theory that hadn't really been worked on for a while about microtubules in the brain potentially being able to achieve these quantum states. And that's where consciousness is coming from. And that a lot about consciousness is quantum. And they've proved that photosynthesis in plants is quantum because it's happening faster than it should. And so there's this, you know, of course we go from plants and people are like, consciousness, the brain, are we quantum as well? And so I think it's a really exciting frontier to, you know, here we have this brain, it is made of matter. And we lug it around every day. We're walking around, we're carrying this organ, which is very mysterious, made of matter. And potentially it helps us connect to the entire universe. And I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, I think I saw that article or a version of that article myself, and I just got lost. I'm just kind of like, okay. And I think there's a really interesting dynamic there. I often kind of think about this and I've written a little bit about it, but when we start trying to get that deep into things, I think we sometimes on the science side practice a little bit of hubris where we kind of believe that we either can or will explain everything with science. And yet science is, you know, science is a creation of this organ that we're talking about, of our brains. And we, no matter how magnificent it is, we also know it's limited and that it filters out a lot of existence and reality from what we're experiencing, and kind of tells us stories, and the stories are the things that help us get by in reality and in existence. So you kind of get into this circular logic, but I always want to kind of also put the brakes on when people are going, oh, we got it figured out. You know, now we know exactly what consciousness is. And I'm like, really? I think one of the most fascinating things that really appeals to me on so many levels is how changeable our brains are. And a concept that, you know, when I talk to people about brain function, they often see it as just like a standard computer. It comes out of the factory with all these connections and all these, you know, I don't know, semiconductors and whatever the heck they are, you know, and all these connections. But that's what you got. You know, you've got your wiring diagram, and that's what you got from that day on. And you can load in a bunch of programs. That's what we're doing right now, and teaching and learning. And, you know, you can load in a bunch of programs, but you got the same old computer that you've always had. If you want a new one, you just go buy a new one, but you can't do that with your brain. But the reality is our brains are changing nonstop. And every experience we have, everything we interact with, every thought we have, everything is altering the way the brain is talking to itself. There is something like 80 to 100 billion neurons. Each one has thousands of connections with other neurons, and they are constantly changing. They're, you know, certain networks are getting strengthened, certain networks are being downgraded, all the way down to one neuron communicating with one other neuron. That's constantly in flux. And I just find that just both fascinating, scintillating, inspiring, because it means that, you know, I think we can always be working towards our better selves and, you know, and thinking better, performing better, feeling better, all that sort of thing. And so sometimes, and the reason why I brought it up is sometimes when I get off into that, you know, really high level, what's consciousness, what's a soul, what's all this sort of thing, I kind of shake my head and go, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to manage any of that, but I do know there's some really fascinating stuff that is going on, and I know how that part works, and it's really cool.
Well, lately, the question on my mind, I mean, I always have questions on my mind, but, you know, they're really talking about this gut-brain connection and how the bacteria in our guts are integral to how our brain processes information, you know, the health of our brain, the health of our bodies, really. And that, you know, maybe when we're craving sugar, it's the bacteria that are like, hey, I should eat some sugar right now for us. And I thought to myself, you know, who's driving this vehicle? Is it this? Or is it like all the little friends that I have living in my digestive system who are actually in charge? And me thinking that I'm in charge is like this illusion. And I'm really being like, I'm like being driven by all these little bacteria in our stomachs. I think it's utterly fascinating.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. I don't know. I was just reading it, not truly reading, I was listening to it, but there's a book on the body by Bill Bryson. I don't know if you know that author, but he's wonderful. And he goes through the body and he makes a point of just kind of what in some ways things, you know, these microbes are dominant species, far more of them, far more adaptable. We got them by the trillions, you know, living in us and using us. Maybe, I don't know. I still like to prefer, prefer to believe that it's up here. But I, you know, there's no two ways that we're being influenced by it. For sure. And, you know, the brain is a very hungry organ, and it wants what it wants, and it wants it now. And if it doesn't get it now, it's pretty petulant. It will punish us. And so it has to act in concert. And, you know, so much of what we get, you know, out of our gut, out of our food and stuff, we depend on those bacteria. If they weren't there, we wouldn't survive.
Thank you so much for indulging me with these kind of side questions. I mean, obviously, I love science very much, so I don't interview many people in your position. So I thank you for entertaining my digressions, shall we say. Well, I would love
by the way, I don't think they're digressions. I think they're great. At least, you know, we have similar sensibilities in what's fascinating us.
Yes, absolutely. It's so true. I can't get enough of certain types of science. So thank you. Well, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like for you as a kid?
Yeah, anything but. I would say, you know, far maybe to... No, that's wrong. It's not to the extreme. I would just say it was essentially never discussed and... You know, at the very most, maybe in an agnostic region on one part, maybe a little further even over to the atheist region in another part. So, yeah, no, I mean, basically, I would say probably close to zero.
Were your parents scientists as well or into, you know, medical research, being in the medical field?
My dad was a general practitioner, so I certainly knew the healthcare world to some degree from him. My mom always told me, she told my girlfriends and fiance eventually, you know, don't marry a doctor. So I think my mom had another opinion about, you know, going into healthcare, but... and thus maybe some of my ambivalence, you know, in my college years. But my mom, you know, it's always interesting to me. She was British. She grew up, you know, was a late year teenager and then young woman during World War II, grew up with bombs going on around her and stuff like that, had to drop out of what would have been high school at the time and, you know, work and stuff related to the war. But she's one of the smartest people I ever knew, you know, just a brilliant, brilliant person. And I think it always underscored you can't judge people by the level of their education. Degrees have never meant much to me. It was really, you know, what is that person and how they process and think, not what degree they've achieved.
So did she live in London then?
She lived in the southwest coast of England near a town called Plymouth, which was flattened because it was a major port city. She had a fiance who was killed, you know, and had multiple harrowing experiences, was in London during some of the Blitz, you know, worked all sorts of jobs related to the war. So it, you know, that conflict was deeply embedded into my, you know, talk about childhood and what influences there are. I mean, I probably read every book there was at the time about World War II. And they used to have friends who would visit, and, you know, one was a Spitfire pilot in the war, and not many of those survived. And another was a guy who took his boat to Dunkirk and helped evacuate troops from Dunkirk. He was just a fishing, you know, captain of a little fishing boat who went over to Dunkirk. So, you know, all that stuff was deep in my psyche. My dad was in the Navy the American Navy. So they met at the end of the war. As a boy, we lived there for a few years as well. We moved there for a few years. I grew up in New Jersey, what I call God's country. And we moved there for a few years, so, and then moved back to Jersey. So it's pretty much the same, you know. suburbs in New York are pretty much like Cornwall. We lived in a little area called Torbay, which is just up the coast from Plymouth. And, you know, I was a little schoolboy there with shorts and a tie and a jacket and stuff like that.
On my mother's side, I have Scottish in my family. And so it's always been one of my dreams to go to Wales and Scotland and walk, just walk. And as far as the, you know, the stone circles and the archaeology, I always think to myself, see what can get done when there's no TV. These are the things we create. We create these things. So, yeah.
By the way, my mom was actually Scottish. So she was Edinburgh born, and they moved down to the southwest coast of England when she was a younger girl. I mean, I think just preteen. Kind of funny, by the way, her father, who had been a veteran of World War I, was injured in the Battle of the Somme and stuff. But anyway, he became a pub manager in this town of Torbay. And just a quick aside, because it's kind of fun, but my mom started feeling like in the middle of the night, somebody would move her bed or open some drawers or open and close the door. And she started, you know, telling her parents about it. And they were like, oh, it's probably, you know, just the train going by, rumbling things around. And after her complaining enough, they looked into it. And they called the former pub manager, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, is that room 23 or whatever it was? He goes, yeah, no, everybody knows that's haunted. And in kind of a typical British fashion, they were like, oh, okay, that explains it. And didn't even move her out of the room.
Have you ever witnessed something that you considered to be a miracle or something magical in your life? Maybe to do with a surgery that you performed or something maybe you witnessed. You didn't have to happen to you, but something that kind of changed the course of your life or made you think differently about this reality that we're in.
Yeah, I think I would go back to one of the original things that I said to you. I would argue that every day was just overflowing with it. Of course, we would have operations that you know, turned out far better than we had anticipated. I mean, it's a rough field. The outcomes are often really bad. You know, there is only so much you can do for a very bad car accident or a gunshot wound to the brain or aneurysm that ruptured or, you know, various types of tumors. And I mean, it just goes on and on. And there's only so much you can do for it. So, you know, we spend a lot of time anticipating the worst, hoping for the best. And once in a while, you'll get the best. And I mean, it feels like a miracle. You do have to counterbalance that with a lot of the bad stuff. But obviously that would always feel great to see somebody you struggled with for maybe weeks get out of the hospital. I mean, that feels like a miracle for sure. Waiting rooms are always packed full of, you know, people who are crying and nervous as all get out. And you go and you say, you know, we're done and everything seems to have gone very well and we're going to see how and, you know, invariably mother, father kind of almost fall onto you crying and thanking you. And I don't even know how you can express what that feels like. It's otherworldly. And so I don't know if you call that a miracle or whatever it is. It's humanity probably at its most acute, its deepest, and you feel it. And, you know, you feel it deep down in your soul, and it's incredibly inspirational. But then, you know, and so there's that. But then, as I was saying, I think every minute of every day, I'd be running into family members. We gave bad news right and left all day long. And I would just be stunned every time that the family members, their courage and their again humanity and how they cared for each other, how they thanked you. It was just like this blanket of grace fell all over everybody. And so I'm just not sure how you could go and experience that and not kind of feel inspired all the time and feel like, yeah, I got to do my best. I got, you know, I've got to throw everything I have into this because, you know, these wonderful people. And, you know, so you think about nowadays in the news, it's so chock full of acrimony and everybody's after each other and we're pointing fingers back and forth. And I know I fall into the trap where I start vilifying the side that I don't agree with. And then I remember those times, you know, every minute of every day when all other pretenses were stripped away, because this was truly life and death, how amazing the grand majority of people are. I mean, so I still believe we're inherently good.
Thanks to all of you who listened to this midweek episode. I'm so very grateful that you take the time out of your day to meet these incredible human beings who are sharing their stories. This week, Gary, he does everything, quite honestly. I'm going to have a link to his website in the episode show notes. And really, he is a prolific author. He writes fiction. He talks about burnout and wellness. You need to check out his website because he just has so much going on and has published so many books. His latest book is Death's Pale Flag, and it's available at most online sites and many local bookstores. And guess what? Guess who the protagonist is? A brain surgeon who's haunted by his work and is now haunted by ghosts. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you can, remember to subscribe to the podcast. If you've already done that, think about giving me a rating or writing a little review or sharing the podcast with friends. Really, sharing the podcast with people is how I'm going to reach a greater audience. And of course, I'm ever so grateful for anything that you do for me for getting this podcast out there. Whatever you do, I'm grateful for. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Gary. Be present to those who need you. Even if it's one of the worst moments in their lives, practice patience, deep listening, and the ability to be present for people. Because I guarantee at some point in your life, you're going to need someone to be present for you. It seems like so many people I know are struggling these days, and really, there's some deep suffering going on in the world. And I really pray and I really wish and hope that every single person that is suffering or struggling, that they have someone like Gary to listen to them and tell them that everything is going to be okay. See you next week for another episode of the podcast. And until then, have a gorgeous rest of your week. I would imagine, you know, I'm listening to your stories and listening to, you know, what you're talking about. And of course, you have the one piece of the intensity and the stress of operating
you know, whether it's a trauma or a car crash or a tumor on someone's brain. So that's the physical piece. But then you have the emotional, mental piece where you have to be present for that entire operation, if it lasts hours or what have you. And just the amount of, like you said, you were fatigued, stress. I am so curious how you took care of your heart during these years of being a neurosurgeon. I mean, I'm hearing you say you have these experiences with these families who have a kid who's having brain surgery, it's probably the worst day of their life. And how, you know, and maybe bringing them good news, maybe bringing them not so good news. How did you keep going? How did you take care of your heart so that, you know, you could continue this work?
Yeah, this is one of the things I really got into, frankly, for, I don't know, the last 10, 15 years, was studying burnout in healthcare providers. And your question is one that I would ask all the time, because this is what we're calling on people and to be doing nonstop. And, you know, every healthcare worker faces some version of all this. And I particularly think of people like the nurses who, you know, it's far more thankless than, you know, what I was doing. I'm being thanked effusively often by the patients, but also, you know, in the bank account. I mean, people are paying us well. And here we have the nurses who get up every day and do truly, you know, unbelievable work. And you know, the systems are always trying to figure out how can we pay those guys less? It's truly, amazing to see. So burnout is a problem. And, you know, there are many factors that affect people. I always felt like this, what you're getting at, has to be a major factor in it. And I believe it is. And I think it's multifactorial. But there's an interesting component to it that I can relate to you, because, you know, up front, you would think, yeah, at some point, this is just going to empty our emotional banks. And I think it does. I think, as I said, early in med school, you know, you start teaching yourself how to block all this stuff off, and it feels like it's not getting in, and then something will turn it on. I often say I went through a lot of it without, you know, ever breaking down or feeling, you know, particularly roughed up by it. And the minute I stepped away from operating, I become a far more emotional person. I start crying over the simplest of things. And I think what that's saying is all that stuff got in there, but for the longest time, you weren't really allowed to get it out. But one day we were talking about, for example, this giving of bad news, because, I mean, you could give horrible news to people 5-10 times in a night, 5-10 different families and all that sort of thing. And I was talking to my group, my team, and saying, you know, this has got to be, you know, eating at our souls. And one of the guys kind of bravely spoke up and said, I got to tell you something really weird. He said, sometimes after I've spoken with a family about something wretched, something horrible, instead of coming out and feeling emptied or feeling like my heart was going to explode, he said, sometimes I feel kind of these warm tinglies that you get when you're feeling good about something. And he said, I'm really embarrassed to say this. I don't know how to explain it. And everybody in the rest of the group started going, yeah, you know, come to think of it, that's true too. And we started exploring it. What we came to was that so often we're not really able to stop the course of the disease or the trauma. But probably one of the major parts of being a doctor, at least we'd like to think, is addressing and trying to help people with suffering of any kind. So in that scenario, and what he said, you know, is he said, I think I do it well. I think I break this bad news well. So I'm empathetic. I'm kind. They understand it. They know that this isn't a runaround. There's no BS to it. That in the end, you know, I can give them some compassion and some understanding at the very least. He goes, I think that's, you know, it gets to the heart of being a doctor. And when I feel like I'm being a good doctor, even though I'm not changing the course of things, I am tending to their needs because they're my patients too. And it was really interesting because everybody was like, I think you may be onto something.